The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. Now we'll begin with the main story section of The Week magazine. The article is entitled, Kane Tested by Sexual Harassment Scandal. What happened? Surprise Republican frontrunner Herman Cain faced the biggest test of his presidential campaign this past week when allegations surfaced that he sexually harassed two women in the 1990s. Two women who worked for Cain while he was chief executive of the National Restaurant Association between 1996 and 1999 complained about his inappropriate behavior toward them and received settlements to leave the association, according to Politico.com. Cain offered conflicting accounts about whether he remembered the specifics of the allegations and whether the women received settlements, and he said there could be legal implications to a lawyer's request that he release the women from confidentiality agreements they signed as a condition of receiving settlements. But Cain insisted that the original allegations were baseless and that the leak to Politico was politically motivated. There are factions that are trying to destroy me, Cain said. I have never sexually harassed anybody in my life. A third former employee told the Associated Press that she also considered filing a complaint against Cain because he invited her to the corporate apartment after telling her how attractive she was. One of the accusers who did file a complaint received severance of a year's salary, $35,000, after alleging that Cain made suggestive comments during a work outing in which there was heavy drinking, according to the New York Times. The developing scandal rallied some conservatives to Cain's defense, and both they and the Cain campaign likened the allegations to those against Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas in 1991. This is another high-tech lynching, said conservative commentator Ann Coulter. It shows liberals are terrified of strong conservative black men. Now here's what the editorial said. Cain deserves the benefit of the doubt, said the New York Post. He had been ambushed anonymously by 15-year-old allegations. The supposed improprieties are confusing and vague. At one point, Politico describes his purportedly offensive gestures as not overtly sexual, but improper in a work setting. Whatever the hell that means. Until Cain stops being evasive, this scandal isn't going away, said the Chicago Tribune. Even self-styled unconventional candidates don't get to stonewall voters on matters like this, especially those running for president. These allegations speak to Cain's character, and character counts a lot. Americans are watching how he handles this threat to his candidacy, and so far something's not adding up. Now here's what the columnist said. Actually, this profoundly underwhelming story tells us nothing about Herman Cain, said David French in the NationalReview.com. As a lawyer who has worked on sexual harassment cases, I can tell you that the existence of a complaint is not proof of guilt. Neither is a settlement. Payments are given out for many different reasons, including to save money that would be spent fighting false claims. These allegations should have no impact on the respect that millions of Americans, myself included, have for this impressive man. That's ridiculous, said Jennifer Rubin in the WashingtonPost.com. The reflexive instinct of some conservatives to circle the wagons when a conservative is accused of something bad is misguided. First of all, it's far more likely that this leak came from one of Cain's Republican adversaries than from liberals who would have waited until after he got the nomination to set off this time bomb. Second, Cain has handled this situation like an amateur. Clearly, he had no idea of what running for president was all about. Republicans really ought to think hard about whether a complete political novice is their best bet to beat President Obama. Kane's presidential campaign will not be damaged, said Jonathan Chait in nymag.com, because there is no Herman Cain presidential campaign. When you run for president, you try to raise a ton of money, campaign aggressively in primary states, and pretend to know something about world affairs. Cain isn't doing any of this. What he's doing is executing a business plan to raise his profile as a conservative personality and make loads of money. Since he can now claim to be persecuted by the liberal media, this scandal will actually help him. The next item from the main story section is entitled, A Familiar Impasse for the Super Committee. What happened? With its deadline drawing near, the Congressional Super Committee, tasked with cutting at least $1.2 trillion from the federal deficit over the next decade, appeared headed for a deadlock this week after Republican leaders said they would reject any plan that included tax increases. The six Democrats on the panel last week submitted a far-reaching plan to cut $3.2 trillion from the deficit by slashing $500 billion from entitlement programs, such as Medicare, and raising $1.3 trillion in new tax revenue. But House Speaker John Boehner said his caucus would never vote for new taxes. It's time for everybody to get serious, he said. A Republican proposal, which aimed to cut $2.2 trillion from the deficit with a mixture of entitlement cuts and a revision of the tax code, was dismissed by House Democrats for failing to increase revenue. Erskine Bowles, who co-chaired President Obama's Debt Reduction Commission last year, told the Super Committee in direct testimony to accept the need for both deeper spending cuts and $800 billion in new taxes. I'm worried you're going to fail. Fail the country, Bowles said. Under a deal that Congress and Obama agreed on during August's debt ceiling battle, the Super Committee must send a 10-year deficit reduction plan to Congress before November 23rd. If no plan is created, it would automatically trigger $1.2 trillion in across-the-board cuts to the federal budget from 2013 onward, a process known as sequestration, including $454 billion from defense programs and $123 billion from Medicare. But Republicans suggested they may vote to cancel at least parts of the sequestration. Congress is not bound by this, said Senator John McCain. If something is passed, we can reverse it. Now here's what the editorial said. Nothing has changed since August, said the New York Times. Congress can't agree on how to cut the deficit, and as usual, only one party seems to be trying. But even though the cuts proposed by the Democrats were so large as to be imprudent, the obstructionist GOP still refuses to consider new taxes. Clearly nothing is, not defense spending, nor the country's economic health, is more important to Republicans than protecting corporations and the wealthy from tax increases. But all the Democrats are offering are non-starters and gimmicks, said the Lynchburg, Virginia News and Advance. These are the same phony cuts and increased stimulus spending proposed by the president, with no mention of real entitlement and tax reform. As a result, we've got that queasy feeling in the pit of our stomachs that we're heading toward another unfixable impasse. And now here's what the columnist said. Our best option to trim the deficit might be to let the deadline pass, said Peter Suderman in Reason.com. The resulting cuts would be hardly dramatic. Medicare would be cut by only 2%, while defense spending would be capped at 2007 levels, a time when our defense budget represented 40% of global military spending. With genuine entitlement and tax reform looking unlikely, sequestration might be the best plausible result for deficit hawks. Go ahead, Super Committee, pull that trigger. That would be a disaster for national security, said Peter Morici in the Baltimore Sun. Our aging military hardware needs more investment, not less, especially at a time when Chinese military spending is on the rise. Once again, the hawks will win this argument, said Michael Tomosky in the DailyBeast.com. Republicans will demand that the Pentagon be exempt from cuts on the spurious basis that they would leave America defenseless. Democrats will cave in for fear of appearing soft on defense. Meanwhile, domestic programs will be brutally cut. Whether the super committee agrees on a plan or not, said Stan Collender in WashingtonMonthly.com, it won't mean much in the long run. Congress has a long history of revising federal budget amendments almost as soon as the ink is dry. It's exceptionally unlikely that a 10-year plan will go unchallenged or unchanged. In reality, only the $30 billion in cuts already agreed upon for 2012 are guaranteed. Cuts and changes beyond that will be changed, waived, ignored, or abandoned by Congress long before they happen. Now let's turn to the controversy of the week, the flat tax, the GOP's cure for what ails the country. Once upon a time, said Michael Tomosky in thedailybeast.com, the concept of a single across-the-board income tax rate was the province of messianic loons on the far right. Now it is getting ever so closer to becoming GOP dogma. Last week, Rick Perry tried to jumpstart his flagging presidential campaign with a proposal to replace the current Byzantine tax code with a simple 20% flat tax. His plan is actually not so simple, since it allows people to file under the old tax code if they prefer. His rival Herman Cain has already proposed a 999 tax plan with a flat 9% on personal income tax and on businesses. Even Mitt Romney, who in 1996 denounced the flat tax proposals of then-candidate Steve Forbes as a tax cut for fat cats, was quoted this summer as saying, "I love a flat tax." "The flat tax is an idea whose time has come," said Lewis Woodhill in Forbes.com. "With the U.S.'s economic growth at a standstill, we need drastic change. A flat tax would free U.S. businesses from the onerous 35% corporate tax rate and trigger the economic boom that we desperately need." "The flat tax is a flat-out fraud," said Robert Reich in the San Francisco Chronicle. "Out of simple fairness, our tax code has always required the rich to pay a greater percentage of their incomes than the poor. The effect of flattening those differences would be to give massive tax cuts to the wealthy and corporations, while raising taxes on the poor and lower middle class at a time of rising inequality." Under Perry's plan, for example, billionaire investor Warren Buffett would see his tax bill slashed from $6.9 million to a paltry $120,000. "Cutting taxes this drastically would have a staggering impact on federal revenues," said Brooks Jackson in USA Today. The nonpartisan Tax Policy Center found that Perry's plan would reduce federal revenues by between $570 billion and $1 trillion in 2015. "Those projections are meaningless," said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. "They assume the economy would be the same size with or without a flat tax, but a flat tax would spur rapid economic growth and thus actually increase federal tax revenues. Does anyone seriously think that reducing the corporate rate to 20% wouldn't attract more capital from abroad, encourage more domestic investment, and increase growth and jobs?" "Other benefits would be far more profound," said Michael Walsh in the New York Post. "With a flat tax, politicians would no longer be able to reward their cronies and contributors with loopholes and tax breaks. Better still, it would strengthen the social fabric by requiring everyone, irrespective of wealth or income, to pay something, even if it's only a pittance." "Are my fellow Republicans bent on political suicide?" said Ross Douthat in NewYorkTimes.com. "If the GOP thinks it's going to regain the White House by telling American voters that their own taxes should go up to pay for a tax cut for the top 10 or 5 or 1% of earners, the party has gone even further into its ideological fantasy land than critics contend. Don't worry, none of the flat tax plans are meant to be taken seriously," said Bruce Bartlett, also in NYTimes.com. "Perry is just using his flat tax proposal as a signaling device to prove to the Republican base that he's more conservative than Romney. As a tax plan, it's a non-starter, but as a political stunt, it might just work." And now from the Week magazine this week, let's turn to the very popular column entitled Good Week 4 and Bad Week 4. It was a good week for freshmen. After a new study found that the freshman 15 is a myth, the average female first-year college student gains 2.4 pounds, while males gain 3.4 pounds, only 0.5 pounds more than their non-collegiate peers. It was a good week for facing reality after Christian radio broadcaster Harold Camping apologized for telling listeners the world would end in the rapture on May 21st, and then again on October 21st. Camping said he was getting out of the prediction business and retiring. It was a good week for multitasking after British woman Emma French passed her driving test while she was in labor and then drove herself to the hospital. The nurses were very confused because I was getting congratulation cards for both my baby and my driving test, said French. It was a bad week for Greece's tax revenues after new research found that there was more Porsche Cayennes in Greece than taxpayers reporting an income of more than $68,000 a year. It was a bad week for privacy after 24-year-old Max Schrems of Austria used a European law to compel Facebook to send him a record of all the personal data it had on him. Schrems received a CD with 1,222 pages of information, including chats and jokes dating back to 2008. And it was a bad week for quick thinking after 24-year-old Kevin Gaylor of Colorado Springs invited a woman he met online to his home. When his girlfriend showed up too, Gaylor allegedly told her that the new woman was a burglar and called the cops to report an intrusion. He was charged with false reporting to authorities. You're listening to our Reading of the Week magazine for this week. Thanks so much for joining me. Now we're going to turn to the People section of the week. Our first item is entitled Waits Hunt for a Father Figure. Tom Waits spent much of his life searching for a father figure, said Tim Adams in the London Observer. The singer-songwriter became fixated on male role models after his dad walked out when he was 10 years old. Waits would visit friends' houses just to hang out with their dads. He'd ask these men grown-up questions such as, "So how long you been at Aetna, Bob?" At 12, he was started carrying his grandfather's walking stick and wearing a trilby. There was a need for maturity and guidance from somewhere, he says, and I was going to have to provide it for myself, even if it meant putting on a hat and looking in the mirror and squinting a bit. As he found solace in music, he developed a new hero, Ray Charles. I never got to know Ray, but I did shake his hand in an airport once, which was a profound moment for me. It wasn't so profound for him, but it wasn't meant to be. After 40 years as a performer, Waits has fans approaching him to shake his hand, and that's maybe profound for them, I guess, he says. But the odd thing about this existence is that you spend half your life trying to get people to listen to you and the rest trying to get them to leave you alone. The next item from the People section is entitled The Woman Whose Husband Became a Mummy. When Janet Billis's husband told her that he'd volunteered to have his body mummified, she didn't take him seriously, said Audrey Ward in the London Times. Alan, a British taxi driver, was always full of madcap ideas, she says, so I didn't pay attention. But earlier this year, Alan, who died of lung cancer at 61, became the first person in 3,000 years to be embalmed using ancient Egyptian techniques. The process was filmed for a TV documentary. Allen liked to be the center of attention, she explains. He also wanted to leave something for his grandchildren. The process fascinated Billis. As soon as he died in January, he was frozen like a pea. In April, scientists from Britain's York University removed his organs. He was then painted with beeswax and oil, left to soak in a saline bath for 35 days, dried out and wrapped in bandages. 6 months later, Billis visited the corpse. "I thought his body would be rock hard, but when I poked his leg and tummy, they were still springy," she says. "His fingers were bent inward, so I slid my fingers around his, and it was like we were holding hands." She found it not at all distressing. "I knew it was Alan's body, but it wasn't really Alan. As he used to say, when you're dead, you're dead." The next item, Grammer's tragic family. Kelsey Grammer was shaped by grief, said Andrew Goldman in the New York Times. He was just 20 when his 18-year-old sister Karen was abducted by three men in Colorado Springs, raped, stabbed, and left bleeding to death in an alley. Grammer had to identify the body. "It was something that stays with you for your whole life," says the actor, who is now 56 years old. "This was the closest person to me genetically and emotionally." Grammer had already dealt with a lot of loss. When he was 12, the grandfather who helped raise him died. A year later, his estranged father was shot dead. "Everybody's got their things that shape them or turn them one way or the other, and I had plenty of mine." The horror of his sister's death caused Grammer to seek solace in alcohol and drugs. "I, being the big brother, thought that I had some responsibility for her death, and that haunted me." He finally confronted these demons when he went to the Betty Ford Clinic in 1996. In rehab, Grammer came to understand that addiction is the result of unresolved grief. "I'm still saddened by my sister's murder, but it doesn't hurt me now like it once did." Now, from the People's section in the Week magazine, we'll turn to the regular feature entitled The Briefing. When eyewitnesses are mistaken, courts are reconsidering the value of eyewitness testimony, which has put many innocent people in jail. Are eyewitnesses reliable? They are mistaken far more often than people think. Every year, more than 75,000 eyewitnesses identify criminal suspects in the U.S., and studies suggest that as many as a third of them are wrong. Mistaken eyewitnesses helped convict three-quarters of the 273 people who have been freed from U.S. prisons on DNA evidence presented by the Innocence Project, a nonprofit legal organization that challenges dubious prosecutions. After a comprehensive 2-year study of eyewitness testimony, the New Jersey Supreme Court concluded that it often leads to false identifications and recently ordered new rules on how such testimony is treated in the courtroom. Other states are moving in the same direction, and this past week, the U.S. Supreme Court will hear a case. This coming week, a U.S. Supreme Court will hear a case that may result in the first federal clarification on the use of eyewitnesses in 34 years. Why are so many eyewitnesses mistaken? Human memory is fragile and malleable. More than 2,000 studies on eyewitnesses in recent decades have determined that recollections are prone to decay, distortion, and suggestion. Honest, well-meaning people often simply misremember or misreport what they have seen. In one 1974 experiment, for example, more than 2,000 people were shown a 13-second video clip of a mugging, followed by a 6-man lineup. Just 14% of viewers correctly identified the perpetrator, a success rate lower than that of random guessing. In a 1999 study, 150 college students watched videos of a shooting and then of a 5-man lineup. Every one of them identified a suspect, even though the culprit was not pictured. Factors such as fear, poor lighting, the presence of a weapon during a crime, and the passage of time have all been shown to cause mistakes in identifications, even when the witness is the victim of the crime. witnesses are particularly inaccurate, studies show, when asked to remember the facial features of someone of a different race. Then why are eyewitnesses so often used in court? They always have been, from biblical times to the present. There's almost nothing more convincing, U.S. Supreme Court Justice William Brennan Jr. wrote in 1981, than a live human being who takes the stand, points a finger at the defendant, and says, "That's the one." The problem is that our justice system hasn't adapted to what modern forensic science has established about memory's failings. Judges and juries tend to give too much credence to eyewitnesses, particularly those who appear confident of their memories and are seen as having little motive to lie. The legal system is set up to kind of sort between liars and truth-tellers, says Gary Wells, a psychology professor at Iowa State University. But when someone is genuinely mistaken, the legal system doesn't really know how to deal with that. What role do the police play? Deliberately or through sloppiness, police often contribute to erroneous identifications. The New Jersey Supreme Court's recent ruling stemmed from a 2004 case in which an eyewitness admitted to being nudged by a detective to identify the defendant. But more subtle suggestions matter, too. If the person running a traditional police lineup knows whom fellow cops suspect of committing the crime, for example, he may provide inadvertent cues to the witness, a glance, a nod, subtle praise. A recognition of this problem has prompted New Jersey, North Carolina, and several U.S. cities to change their lineup procedures, and 10 other states are now considering changes as well. What weights do courts give eyewitness testimony? Quite a lot. Most states and the federal courts abide by a 1977 U.S. Supreme Court decision, Manson v. Braithwaite, which upheld a suspect's conviction even though the police officer who identified him was not shown photos of any other suspects. Under what has become known as the Manson test, a witness's reliability can be taken into account in the courtroom, but his confidence in his memory is considered an indication that he can be trusted. Studies have shown, however, that a confident witness isn't necessarily a correct one. In its recent ruling, the New Jersey Supreme Court set out specific factors, including lighting and how long the witness was able to look at a suspect, to determine whether testimony is admissible. Defendants will be given more opportunities to challenge identifications, and judges will be required to hold pretrial hearings on those challenges. Finally, juries will be given detailed instructions about the fallibility of witnesses' memories. Does everyone agree? No. Telling jurors that victims may be mistaken will only further validate the current victim-blaming culture, says Stacy Malone, executive director of the Victim Rights Law Center, and some argue that evaluating eyewitness testimony with more complex procedures will further slow trials in already overextended courts. But reformers say the justice system has to reflect evolving standards of evidence. There's critical mass concerning eyewitness reform, says Barry Scheck of the Innocence Project. The science dictates it has to change. And now here is the footnote to this particular briefing article. The rapist who wasn't. When a man broke into Jennifer Thompson's apartment in 1984 and raped her, the 22-year-old college student made a point of studying his face so she could later identify him. When she picked Ronald Cotton out of both a photo and a physical lineup, she was dead sure she'd found her attacker, and the jury took just 40 minutes to find him guilty. In prison, Cotton met an inmate who bragged that he committed the rape. At a new trial, Thompson looked at the two men and again chose Cotton. "I've never seen the other man," she said, nearly a decade later. DNA proved the other inmate had been her rapist. Because Cotton was the only person who appeared in both lineups presented to Thompson, she may have unconsciously settled on him as her attacker. She didn't recognize the real rapist in court because she'd been picking Cotton all along, says memory expert Elizabeth Loftus. After more than a decade in prison, Cotton was exonerated. He and Thompson, now friends, traveled the country lobbying for reformed identification procedures. Now, from the briefing section, we'll turn to the best columns in the U.S. this week, according to The Week magazine. Our first one is entitled, Shed No Tears for Gaddafi, by Charles Krauthammer in The Washington Post. Muammar al-Gaddafi may have had a rotten death, said Charles Krauthammer, but he earned every minute of it. Grainy camera footage of the Libyan tyrant's violent end at the hands of an angry mob of revolutionary soldiers has human rights groups wringing their hands in moral condemnation. But Gaddafi had other options. Months ago, he was offered a chance to leave Libya and live out his days in asylum in Nicaragua or Saudi Arabia. He might even have negotiated for international amnesty for his crimes. Instead of that nice fat retirement, Gaddafi vowed to fight to the death, shelling and killing thousands of Libyans in a final display of egomaniacal madness. He got what he chose. For all the suffering the tyrant inflicted over decades, he suffered perhaps an hour of torment and a bullet to the head. By any standard of cosmic justice, that's mercy. His end also serves as a visual object lesson for Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and other dictators. If you choose to keep on butchering your citizens, the Gaddafi video showed them, one day you too will be dragged from a stinking sewer pipe, abused, taunted, and then shot. The next column is entitled, Zombies Are Feasting on Our Fears, by Tori Bosch in Slate.com. The erudite have a new favored monster, the zombie, said Tori Bosch. The latest fad in kitschy entertainment is TV shows, movies, and novels about soulless ghouls who stalk the living, devouring their flesh, intestines, and brains. Zombies are the stars of the TV drama The Walking Dead, which draws 7 million viewers a week, and of a new literary zombie novel, Zone One. Even Brad Pitt is filming a zombie movie titled World War Z. Why zombies? They're a perfect metaphor for the nation's economic horror show capturing white-collar workers' worst fears. As zombies take control of the earth, the social order, and economy disintegrate, the people who are at most likely to survive can handle weapons, hunt, grow food, or repair cars and generators. Urban and suburban sophisticates find that they no longer have any status or value and are doomed to become prey for heartless, flesh-hungry monsters. Sound familiar? The zombie scenario takes our deepest economic fears and explodes them. But don't despair, the economy will eventually improve and we'll move on to some new way to terrify our, to terrify ourselves. And our third column for this from this section of the Week magazine is entitled Steve Jobs' Final Moments by Mona Simpson in the New York Times. Steve Jobs died just as he lived, said his sister Mona Simpson. My brother spent his final months embarking on new projects at Apple that he asked colleagues to finish, designing what he hoped would be the most beautiful yacht in the world, and relishing his time with his wife and four children. When he knew he was fading, he called me, telling me to get to his home in Palo Alto that day. I'm afraid you won't make it on time, honey, he said. When I arrived, he and his wife, Laureen, were talking and joking, and the kids were gathered around him. Then Steve's breathing changed, becoming severe, deliberate, purposeful. And it was clear he was on an arduous journey, some steep path. He seemed to be climbing. He was working at dying, just as he'd worked so hard at living. Just before he closed his eyes for the last time, the man who spent his life in search of beauty looked past those of us at his bedside at something only he could see. Steve's last words were, "Oh, wow, oh, wow, oh, wow." And now we'll flip through to the back of the magazine here and look at the popular feature in the week called The Last Word. This particular item is entitled, This at Last Was Life. In the chaos of the Chicago Sun-Times City Room, says Roger Ebert, I met my heroes and found my fate. For a kid from downstate Chicago was the great city over the horizon. We read Chicago's newspapers and listen to its powerful AM radio stations. Long after midnight, I listened to Jack Eigen on WMAQ, broadcasting live from the Chez Paris, chatting with Martin and Lewis or Rosemary Clooney. Thomas Wolfe had taught me that my destiny waited in New York, but Chicago was obviously the first step on my path. I walked up Wabash Avenue to the Sun-Times Daily News building, which looked like a snub-nosed ship on the banks of the Chicago River. A boat was moored at its dock, and a crane was offloading huge rolls of newsprint. Editors Jim Hoag and Ken Towers took me out the back way to lunch at Ricardo's and offered me a job. I would work under Dick Takuchi, the editor of the paper's Sunday magazine. He was a cigar smoker, calm, confiding, tactfully showing a green kid the ropes. He gave me a desk close to his in the back row of the city room. At lunch, I began joining Takuchi and Jack McFall, the magazine's copy editor, who wrote Deadlines and Monkey Shines, the best account of the front page era, when the Chicago dailies went at each other with hammer and tongs and hitmen. He was my living connection to that era. When Friday of my first week came around, I joined a general emigration to Ricardo's, where reporters from all four Chicago papers gathered to gobble free hors d'oeuvres. I felt a glow of camaraderie. I knew I lacked authenticity in this company. I was young and unseasoned, but I discovered there was nothing like drinking with the crowd to make you a member. I copied the idealism and cynicism of the reporters I met at Ricardo's and around the corner at the downscale but equally famous Billy Goat's. I spoke like they did, laughed at the same things, felt that I belonged. At about 6 p.m. on New Year's Day of 1967, only two lights on the fourth floor were burning, mine and Mike Rocchio's. It was too early for the graveyard shift to come in. Rocchio walked over to the Sun-Times to see who else was working. A historic snowstorm was beginning. He asked me how I was getting home. I said I'd take the train. He said he had his old man's checker car and would drop me at the L station. He had to make a stop at a 24-hour drugstore right where the L crossed North Avenue. Rocchio, at 35, was already the city's most famous newspaper man, known for complex emotions evoked with unadorned prose in short paragraphs. Growing up as the son of a saloon keeper, he knew how the city worked from the precinct level up and had first attracted attention while covering City Hall. He was 10 years older than me and had started at the old City News Bureau, the cooperative supported by all the dailies that provided frontline coverage of the police and fire departments. Underpaid and overworked, kids worked under the hand of its editor, Arnold Dornfeld, who sat beneath a sign reading, If your mother says she loves you, check it out. When I met Rocchio, he'd been writing his daily news column for 2 years. He chain-smoked Pall Malls and spoke in a gravelly poker player's voice. He drank too much, which to me was an accomplishment. That snowy night, the all-night drugstore was crowded. Come on, kid, he said. Let's have a drink at the eye-opener place. He told me what an eye-opener was. This place opens early. The working guys around here, they stop in for a quick shot on their way to the L. It was a bar under the track, so tiny that the bartender could serve everyone without leaving his stool. Two blackberry brandies and short beers, Rocchio said. He told me, blackberry brandy is good for hangovers. You never get charged for a beer chaser. I sipped the brandy and a warm glow filled my stomach. It may have been the first straight shot of anything I'd ever tasted. I'd been in Chicago 4 months, and I was sitting under the L tracks with Mike Rocchio, in the eye-opener place. I was a newspaper man. A Blackhawks game was playing on WGN radio. The team scored, and again, this, at last, was life. "Geez, they're scoring like crazy," I said, after the third goal in less than a minute. "Where are you from, kid?" "Urbana," I said. "Ever seen a hockey game?" "No." "That's what I thought." "Those are the game highlights." I began to be welcome in Rocchio's cubicle. It amused him to explain the obvious to the downstate kid. He wrote an old manual typewriter. He wrote on an old manual typewriter, not his own, just one from the office pool. His office was filled with newspapers, books, letters, coffee cups, ashtrays, and ties that he had taken off and thrown in the corner. He sat in a swivel chair with his back to the river, and there was a straight-back chair for his visitors. He had a lot of visitors. Mike could have written this column at any time from anywhere, and his editors would have been happy to have it. But he spent 8 hours a day, sometimes longer, at the paper. He was the soul of the Daily News, and the honorary soul, by osmosis, of the Sun-Times. No journalist in Chicago was more admired. On April 1, 1967, the feature editor Bob Zonka called me into the conference room and told me I was being named the paper's film critic. He said Eleanor Keene, the current critic, was taking early retirement. When I walked back into the newsroom, Ellie was smiling across from her desk. She said she would finally not be asked 5 times a day if she'd seen any good movies lately. Actually, what people are more likely to ask is, "How many movies do you see in a week?" They ask if no one had ever thought of that question before. Gene Siskel told me that as an experiment, he tried answering 10. He said people mostly just nodded and said, "Thanks." I'd written a few reviews for my college newspaper, but being a movie critic was not my career goal. If I had one at all, it was to become a columnist like Rocchio. When the Daily News folded in 1978, Mike worked at the Sun-Times until Rupert Murdoch bought the paper in late 1983. This was a crushing blow to Mike. He went home and had a few drinks, and when the local TV stations brought their cameras into his den, he announced that a Murdoch paper was not fit to wrap fish in. The next afternoon, I sat with him at Billy Goat's. "I guess I resigned, huh?" "Murdoch doesn't care what you say about him," I said. "It's not what I said about him," Mike said. "It's that after describing a Murdoch paper that way, how can I work there?" Before the Daily News folded, the city rooms of the two papers shared the fourth floor separated by a glassed-in no-man's land called the Wire Room, ruled by copy boys, pot dealers where teletypes chattered and printers turned out wire photos. The city room was a noisy place to work. Typewriters hammered at carbon copy books that made an impatient slap, slap, slap. Phones rang the way phones used to ring in the movies. Reporters shouted into them. They called out, "Boy," and held up a story, and a copy kid ran to snatch it and deliver it to an editor. We worked at desks, democratically lined up next to one another, row after row. And Landers, epi-lettery, had an office full of assistants somewhere else in the building, but insisted on sitting in the middle of this chaos. When you went on an interview, you took 8 sheets of copy paper, folded them once, and ripped them in half, using a pica stick. Then you folded them again. Now you had a notebook of 32 pages to slip in your pocket with your ballpoint. You had a press card. You were a reporter from the Chicago Sun-Times. In the 1990s, one of my young editors asked if it was really true they allowed reporters to smoke at their desks in the old days. Yes, and drink too, if they could get away with it. Reporters sent Milton the copy boy out the rear loading dock to Billy Goat's to fetch them a drink and a paper coffee cup. Billy Goat's was a dive so subterranean that after you already on the lower level of Michigan Avenue, you had to descend another flight of stairs. There really was a short order cook like John Belushi's Saturday Night Live character shouting, "Cheeseburger, cheeseburger, cheeseburger, cheaps, no flies. Jim Hoag ruled a gifted staff that collected 6 Pulitzers. He once financed an elaborate sting in which the paper opened and operated a bar called the Mirage and was able to develop a 30-day series of articles about the graft and corruption involved. After Murdoch bought the paper, Hoag became the publisher of the New York Daily News and later the editor of Foreign Affairs magazine. He was back in Chicago in early 2011, and at a brunch with some survivors of those days, he said, "We were right there on the edge of doing something great." There was still pain in his voice. Bob Zonka became my best friend and father figure. He was a chain smoker with thinning hair and a gut and such charm that he was devastatingly successful with women. He was the last editor at the paper who worked himself up from copy boy, a passionate editor, and a decent man. When Polish jokes were an epidemic in the 1970s, he refused to listen to them. "When a joke diminishes anyone, it diminishes me." At his funeral, John Anderson, a former Daily News columnist, said, "I spend more hours talking with Zonka than anyone except my three wives, and more quality time than with anyone." Such were the days. There was adrenaline in the city room when a big story broke. The resignation of Nixon, the death of Mayor Richard J. Daley, the time when an L train derailed and we could see it from the office window. The afternoon when J. McMullen, then the Daily News City Hall reporter, later married to Mayor Jane Byrne, commandeered the paper's suite at the Executive House across the river and phoned the office to tell us to check out a balcony on the 17th floor. There he was, the phone to his ear, waving, standing next to a woman. They were both stark naked. One day, our columnist Bob Green heard a 5-bell alert ring on the AP wire and walked over to the machine. I looked up to see if it looked like anything. He walked over with tears in his eyes. "Elvis just died," he said. And that article was from Life Itself by Roger Ebert, dated 2011 by Roger Ebert, and reprinted by permission from Grand Central Publishing. And as we continue with our reading of the week magazine, we'll turn to the section entitled Talking Points for the Week. The first item is entitled The $1 Bill, Why It Might Be Phased Out. A new cost-saving idea is gaining currency in Washington, said Gregory Court in USA Today. It's a proposal to replace the dollar bill with a coin. The Congressional Supercommittee, set up to reduce the national debt, is considering phasing out the one-buck note as a means to save $5.6 billion over 30 years. Paper dollars wear out after around 3 years and must be constantly replaced, while coins theoretically last forever. But traditionalists say the dollar bill bearing George Washington's face is a treasured American icon, and that any savings would be minuscule. "We've tried $1 coins before," said the Daytona Beach, Florida News Journal in an editorial, "and both the Susan B. Anthony and the Saskatchewan flopped. One was 1979, the other in 2000. You may remember those. Americans like the $1 bill. Dollar coins are heavy, they're irritating, and they're impractical. Imagine the poor waiter or waitress who gets 30 $1 tips in one night, trying to lug their wages home." They'd get used to it, said the Wisconsin State Journal. In most other Western nations, the equivalent of a dollar coins are part of everyday life. And while the savings here would not be enough to balance the federal budget or pay down America's enormous debt, killing the paper dollar would be a symbolic way to create momentum for bigger cuts. After all, you have to start somewhere. "And while we're at it," said Los Angeles Times, "let's scrap the penny as well. The U.S. Treasury loses around $70 million a year minting the copper-clad anachronism, since it costs 2 cents to make each one. We could just as easily round up to the nearest nickel. Nostalgia is not a good reason to keep costly, outdated forms of currency around." Getting rid of the paper dollar might seem like a no-brainer, said the Washington Post, but it has already generated fierce opposition and controversy. What a perfect illustration of how difficult it is to reduce any federal expense, no matter how modest. On the pro-coin side, you have steel workers unions and metal mining industry groups. On the other, you have paper and ink manufacturers and groups like the National Armored Car Association, which claims that hauling heavy coins would increase fuel costs. When even this relatively minor issue is subject to intense special interest lobbying, the chances of Congress reaching an agreement on big stuff like Medicare, Social Security, and defense seem smaller than ever. Our next item from the Talking Points is entitled Catholic Church on the same side as Occupy Wall Street movement. Does the Catholic Church support the Occupy Wall Street movement, asked E.J. Dionne in the Washington Post? That certainly would appear to be the case after the Vatican's Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace issued a powerful critique of unchecked capitalism last week that closely echoes the sentiments of the protesters. The council calls for an end to selfishness, collective greed, and hoarding of goods, and for the establishment of a world central bank to regulate the flow of capital. Like the protesters in Zuccotti Park and more than 100 cities, the Vatican Council challenges the morality of widening income inequality and calls for the economic system to serve the global common good, not the interests of a few. Not surprisingly, my conservative Catholic friends are horrified and are now trying to wriggle around the fact that the Church and Pope Benedict XVI are progressive in matters of social justice. Rubbish, said George Weigel in NationalReview.com. This document doesn't speak for the Pope, it doesn't speak for the Vatican, and it doesn't speak for the Catholic Church. It is not a papal directive, but a note from a rather small office in the sprawling Vatican bureaucracy. To suggest that obscure bureaucrats' musings align the Pope with Occupy Wall Street is grossly ill-informed or tendentious to the point of irresponsibility. How can anyone take this document seriously, said Samuel Gregg, also in NationalReview.com. As a solution to inequality and recessions, it recommends a global superbank, a notion left over from leftist utopian thinking of the 1930s. There's nothing new in this naive text, and it can be safely ignored. You may ignore it if you like, said Catholic theologian Thomas J. Reese in NPR.org. But the reality is that when it comes to economic justice, Pope Benedict XVI is to the left of President Obama. Heck, he is even to the left of Nancy Pelosi. In a 2009 encyclical, the Pope decried the fact that inequalities are on the increase across the globe and called for economics to be guided by an ethics which is people-centered. When it comes to sexual matters, conservatives love to cite the Vatican's moral authority, said Andrew Sullivan in thedailybeast.com. But when the Church comes out against the Iraq War, torture, and now the economic inequality that's fueling worldwide protests, the right pretends not to hear, and they call others cafeteria Catholics. The next item is entitled Abortion, Defining Fertilized Eggs as Persons. Could destroying a one-cell organism make you a murderer? Asked the Newark, New Jersey Star-Ledger in an editorial. Mississippi voters will get to answer that question on November 8th when they vote on a personhood amendment to the state's constitution. If the amendment is passed, a fertilized human egg would be considered a legal person in Mississippi, and any action that destroys one could be viewed as murder. That means all abortions would be illegal, even in the case of rape and incest, or a pregnancy that places the mother's life in danger. The legal ramifications don't stop there, said the San Jose Mercury News. Birth control methods that prevent fertilized eggs from implanting in the uterus, such as IUDs and morning-after pills, would also be illegal. And there'd be no more in vitro fertilization, since many eggs are fertilized and destroyed in that process. Mississippi is on the brink of returning to the Dark Ages. Don't listen to these baseless rumors, said Dr. Eric Webb in the Hattiesburg, Mississippi American. If this life-saving amendment passes, women will still be able to use most hormonal birth control pills, which have never been proven to cause abortion. As for ectopic and other pregnancies that might threaten a mother's life, the legal principles of self-defense will adequately protect women and physicians from prosecution. So why are pro-choice activists making these cruel and misleading assertions, asked Donald Wildman in the Pascagoula Mississippi Press. It's simple. Abortion providers like Planned Parenthood profit from the legalized killing of fetuses. So it's in their interest to deny unborn babies a constitutional protection we'll all take for granted, the right not to be murdered. The battle over a legal abortion is now entering a new chapter, said Iron Carmen in Salon.com. Mississippi is the most conservative state in the nation, and the amendment is likely to pass. Pro-life activists are trying to get personhood amendments on the ballots in Ohio, South Dakota, and Florida in 2012. When several states define embryos as persons, the movement will try to overturn Roe v. Wade. If you think the U.S. Supreme Court won't go that far, consider this. Justice Harry Blackmun, author of the Roe decision, noted during the 1973 hearing that the basis for legal abortion would collapse if this suggestion of personhood is established. That's the pro-life movement's ultimate goal, and Mississippi will be the first step. Now, as we reach the end of our program for this week, let's take a look at a few short items. The income of the middle class rose 40% in inflation-adjusted dollars between 1979 and 2007, according to a new Congressional Budget Office report. For the poor, the income increase was 18% during the same period. For the top 1%, income soared by 275%. Indian, Chinese, and other foreign nationals earn 70% of U.S. doctorates in electrical engineering and half the master's degrees in that specialty, which usually leads to a career in information technology. Non-citizens now launch half of Silicon Valley startup companies as well. The House of Representatives will be in session for 109 weekdays in 2012 and will be in recess for 151 weekdays so members can campaign back in their districts. There are just 6 scheduled congressional workdays in January, 3 in August, and 5 in October. You can tell election year is coming. Let's look at the poll watch. 57% of Americans support President Obama's decision to withdraw all U.S. troops from Iraq by the end of the year, while 31% oppose it. And 83% of Americans say they have made cutbacks in their day-to-day spending, including 39% who say they've stopped buying items that consider to be necessities. Nonetheless, 69% consider their own financial situations to be fairly good or very good. We have just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.